Welcome back to the Disrupt Education Podcast. Allie is now in Arizona. How'd you get to Arizona, Allie?
Well, you know, I love to travel, but it's definitely related to skydiving. Let's be honest.
Of course.
The weather. Yeah, of course. I do have family in the area, but I had the opportunity to come down here, do some work, and then also be close to Skydive Arizona. And I literally took the opportunity and went with it. So I'll be here for about 3 weeks, Peter.
Do you ever fly on the, while you're flying down there, do you just kind of look out of the airplane and say that'd be a good drop zone? I was just wondering.
You know what? I do actually like stare out the plane and think about like, oh, what a beautiful area to land in. And then funny story, as we get started with this awesome episode, I cannot wait to jump in, but I think people will think this is funny who followed the skydiving journey. So in between my layovers in Denver, a nice gentleman took my bag down, which I have a hard shell case bag that I put my rig, my parachute in. And he's like, what do you have in this rig? Do you have a bag of bricks in here? And I was like, actually, sir, I have a magic backpack that has two parachutes in it. And he was like, no kidding. He just was absolutely like, can we look at it? And I was like, probably not. I got to go. But
wow. So you're carrying on. There's no questions there. I know that they're not going to question you. You're carrying on parachutes to planes. Yeah. All right. No problems there. But that kind of leads us into legalities and cutting wood and all kinds of awesome stuff that, man, I am so glad to hear that one of our guests is doing some amazing things in that area when it comes to what we used to call industrial tech, but we'll ask him a little bit more about that. And then the legalities behind it. Allie, who do we have with us today?
We have Patricia and Mike. Okay. And let's just set the stage for everybody here. Peter and I have been talking about the red tape issues around education and the legal side. And guess what? We have found some people who can actually speak to it far beyond what Peter and I could ever do. Again, this topic has come up over and over again in episodes. We've had our network express interest in this topic. And I and Peter went on a LinkedIn rabbit hole, found Patricia, who then linked us up with Mike. And so I want to let them introduce themselves a little bit, and then we'll kind of dig into the topic.
Yeah, sure. So Patricia, go ahead first, because you are the red tape cutter. And we're going to see if you can actually get skydiving in high school.
Well, we'll see. We'll see. Right,
we'll do so, one.
You know, I'm a former educator who wanted to go to law school to learn how to advocate better on behalf of students. And so during that time, I actually homeschooled a little girl for 4 years while I went to law school at night. And then when I was done with law school, had the opportunity to work for a governor here in New Jersey on education issues, and then be the chief legal and external affairs officer at the New Jersey Department of Education for several years. And now I get to work with school districts, nonprofits, advising them on legal matters, as well as work with them on government relations and helping advise our decision makers in our state capital about education, about the laws, about education policy.
This is going to be great, because now we have, so I'll tell you what, Mike, and when I took shop actually in middle school, I'm going to guess you are in a shop, but give yourself an introduction here. But lawyers and shop members don't really mix in my world, dude. So talk a little bit. It's great to have you here, Mike, but give us a little brief introduction on who you are.
Absolutely. Thank you, Peter, Allie, Patricia. It's excited to be here. So my name is Michael Schloff, and I founded Maplewood Shop in 2016 after a long digital career. I was a marketer, advertising agencies, advertising technology, product management, corporate strategy. And all along, I had this need to work with my hands. I had a very white collar PowerPoint and Excel team meeting kind of job, but would go home and do woodworking for fun. In 2015, a friend asked me to lead a table at a maker fair in our town of Maplewood, New Jersey. And I found my calling. It was truly an epiphany of what I should be doing with my life. And so I used my business skills to put together a plan to open a storefront woodworking school in Maplewood called Maplewood Shop. And our mission since the beginning has been to help all children develop life skills through woodworking. After only a few months of teaching children in Maplewood, I met a school teacher from New York City who wished she could do the same in her classroom. And it got me to thinking about what if I could invent a tabletop woodworking device. And it was like the Seinfeld episode with the muffin top, if you remember that.
Yes.
And so I was like, what if I could just have the good bits of a woodworking table and let the school provide the table? So I invented this workbench that we use. Then I decided to use hand tools instead of power tools, largely for portability and also to not compete with any insurance needs. And we'll talk a lot more about this. Then I developed a curriculum that went with it. And the biggest insight was that I could train teachers to teach woodworking. They knew how to teach. That was the hard part. The woodworking was simply an incremental skill. And so by 2017, we were in our first school in New York City. And I'm pleased to say that now we're in 150 schools and camps around the country and a few internationally and growing and helping children not only discover life skills, but to discover this intelligence in their hands and push what used to be called shop down from, say, 11th grade into sixth grade for all these same reasons. And so excited to share more about that.
When Patricia like mentioned your work and we looked it up, we're like, okay, how did you guys meet? Did you help with the legal side of this? Because I mean, as Peter said, when I think of woodworking class and shop class, I'm thinking, oh my goodness, what are all of the legal issues that you would have to even like prompt a school to be like, well, who's going to prevent the children from cutting their hands off or hammering nails into their legs? I don't know, like just running around with these tools if you're not going to have a quote unquote a qualified shop teacher. And I say this because my dad was an industrial arts shop teacher, and the training that he had to do in order to get that certification, if people aren't aware of this, it's extensive. It was even more extensive than any other teacher certificate. And so, yeah, talk us through all of that.
Absolutely. So when I started teaching locally, I was concerned about safety. And I thought power tools are just too complex, too dangerous, so I'm not going to do that. I found insurance somehow. And but it was very risky, right? I had no track record. Now, you know, thousands, maybe 8,000 students later, neurotypical, neurodiverse, we're in schools that are court mandated for behavioral issues. And it's always the same story, that it's the occasional Band-Aid. And schools now view this like using scissors. There's no real difference for them. So when we talk about shop or vocational exploration or vocational training, yes, people always assume the bad old days, which were also good old days. The bad part was that the teacher would usually hold up both hands and show off a missing finger and scare the kids into submission, right? The good old days part was that it was tremendous training. It was great for, there's multiple pathways to success. Some include college, some don't. And now there's hybrids, where we'll talk in a minute about a program from the Carpenters Union that carries 16 college credits even in high school. So you can definitely have it both ways, and all our old constructs and dichotomies are kind of fading. That said, I started with hand tools because they were simpler. And the workbench was not only born from the teacher and the desire for portability, it was born out of an accident in one of my classes, where we were using chisels and the vices we were using weren't good enough. The lighting wasn't great. And a student was holding the work with one hand, slipped, and needed stitches. So now we don't use chisels. But I learned that if you can hold the wood securely, it eliminates most of the issues. And that's sort of at a functional level. So, you know, there's the workbenches are one of the reasons. The other thing I learned along the way, and I didn't even have the vocabulary for it back then, but it was social emotional learning, SEL. And now this is audio, so you can't see behind me, but behind me there's a safety poster. And the top half of the safety poster has all sorts of social emotional learning lessons, such as something will go wrong, how you deal with it is what matters. Because I notice kids getting frustrated. And so grounding them. Another is be mindful of your environment. Another says help others and ask for help. So in all these different ways, we give the students permission to be present, to be careful, to not worry about pixel perfection right out of the gate, which is what, you know, a digital life has taught them. And so we give them permission to grow and have a growth mindset. That alone has prevented so many accidents. After that, we train them on how to use the tools, and we have a very purposeful, scaffolded approach, starting with small tools and working their way up. Again, no power tools. So a moment's inattention with one of our saws is a Band-Aid, whereas in your father's classroom, it was life-changing, right? In a bad way. So we've got our social emotional learning, we've got the workbenches, we're only using hand tools. And those hand tools are what built the Eastern Seaboard. I mean, hand tools were common until the 1920s. So it's pretty astounding what you can do without powered tools. And now we've even managed to, we work with the Carpenters Union quite a bit, which has a tremendously wonderful curriculum, but generally requires power tools and an experienced shop teacher. And so now we've adapted under an agreement with them, their curriculum to work with our hand tool setup and our approach. And so that's operating in several New Jersey schools as well.
I see red tape everywhere. I love it. Absolutely. And if you go back, honestly, when you say to, you know, just your father's, that was me. Because in Indiana, I grew up in Indiana, small town. I don't think there's any laws there. I just don't. Like, it's kind of the Wild West in Indiana for some reason. I can describe my shop class nowhere near what like your safety record is right now. Not that we had kids messing around or anything, but the tools were just like, yeah, it was insanely dangerous. Now that I look back on it, when you're in it, you don't really know. But Patricia, I want to ask you then, so what, to in layman's terms, right? A lot of our listeners are going to be educators and administrators. So without going too far into the law degree, can you tell us, like, what were the steps? How did you get from this idea to actually being able to get it into schools on a from a legal lens?
Sure, sure. So Mike and I actually work together. We're actually board members on a museum that focuses on early trades and crafts. And so unfortunately, I didn't have the good fortune of working with Mike specifically at that time. But I've worked with many school districts as well as many nonprofits who've said, I've got this great idea. It's great for kids. How do we do this? And, you know, I think the very first thing I would say is where there's a will, there's a way, right? And so when somebody has a passion, you know, who has an idea that would be great for kids and like proven effective, it's very easy to see what the challenges are going to be and then work around those roadblocks. So one example Mike gave, right? Very quickly, he made a determination. I can still run a really great program without power tools, right? You don't need a full, you know, a full lab. You don't need, you know, a full room with power saws. You know, I can do this with a bench. He also found a really unique way of training the trainer, right? He said he had teachers, right, who knew how to teach, right? It's just the content he had to give them, you know. That is a huge asset. Some of the legal issues, though, you know, our mind always goes first and foremost to students, right? That's who our stakeholders are, though. That's who we're working with. And so certainly the natural things that come to mind are their safety, right? Is there parental permission through parental permission slips, right? Like, is school nurse on board? You know, do you have adequate supervision? But the lawyer side of me thinks of all of the other laws that are around, right? So Peter, you said, you know, no laws out there. Well, in New Jersey, we're dealing with federal law, you're dealing with state law, and then sometimes you're dealing with local contracts as well. So Mike and I are both here in New Jersey. There are 600 school districts in New Jersey. Each one has a different teacher's contract. Mm-hmm. So I'm thinking when Mike's talking about training the trainer, what are those teachers saying, right? What is this part of their contract? This is kind of beyond the scope of what normal teachers teach and what they're certified for. And so then there becomes a legal issue of, can a teacher say, hey, that sounds like a really cool program, but I don't really want to deal with SAWS and I really don't want to teach, like, that this is beyond the scope of my contract. And then how are you going to, you know, get the teachers union to buy into that and support you in doing that? So there's actually a lot of labor issues you have to consider, as well as, you know, even just simple things like workman's compensation and disability. God forbid you do have someone who gets injured. You know, is this really within the scope of their teacher duties? Do you suddenly have to rewrite some teacher descriptions to cover some of this stuff? So these are just some of the issues that pop into my mind as I'm hearing Mike talk about this program. But like I said, usually if there's a passion and you can have a conversation, as well as if you have a good school leader who, you know, really drives staff to be excited mm-hmm. about a program, a lot of those challenges just seem to fade away.
That's what I'm really interested in is, right, Mike? So Patricia's listing in my mind a whole lot of red tape, even ones that I even considered, and I'm sure you're just scratching the surface. So from your side, implementing a program, because we talk to a lot of innovative people who are doing innovative things, and oftentimes, like, the software side, you know, seems to get pushed through pretty easily, or, you know, integrative technology solutions and whatnot. But I know that Peter and I are huge advocates for hands-on, you know, manipulation, getting kids off of screens, which is what your work comes in. So from your perspective, you know, like, maybe your biggest challenge isn't the legal side, but like, how have you been able to kind of work through, you know, pushbacks, or, because this is a creative opportunity. So what have you seen, and like, how have you been able to overcome them? Because you're in 150 plus schools.
Right. Exactly. So Patricia's point around where there's a will, there's a way is 100% our experience. Until recently, we have been working with early adopters, and those school leaders, those early adopters have charisma, right? A lot of school leaders have charisma, and there's a lot of school leaders that have various strengths. There's a certain type of person that adopts a new program and takes the risk. Those were the, say, first 100. Now we can show statistics around how other schools have dealt with it. It's less scary. It's less unknown. So to answer your question very directly, what we do now is we're lucky enough to have CBS News, CBS 2 New York City, do a segment on us, and the link will be available in the description. Mm-hmm. And they show off the program, and the teachers are excited. In that video, the two teachers are the gym teacher and the math teacher. And they also interview the assistant principal. And you can see the enthusiasm from the children. You can see the enthusiasm from the teachers, from the administration. And there's two quick points here. One is that for the administration, there's trade-offs. There's legal considerations, and there's recruitment and retention of teachers. And we find more and more that a new principal says, well, how do I recruit my teachers? And we say, send them this video and say, I'm thinking, you, the principal, are thinking about implementing this program, who might be interested? And so it becomes a pull strategy of drawing the teachers who want to do it in, and anyone who raises their hand, because they're already a certified teacher, is capable, because we can train anyone. 90% of the teachers we train have no background in woodworking. It helps if they're a little visual spatial, but otherwise, anyone. The other point is that by using hand tools, we didn't want to go up against teacher union And so we didn't want to staff against the programs. We wanted to enable the teachers and empower the teachers to run it themselves. Further, we did not, by choosing to use only hand-powered tools, we avoided certifications. So in the elementary school, where teachers are allowed to teach anything, no problem. In the middle schools, sometimes it becomes an elective, and that's okay too. And then in the high schools, it can become an elective, but still be this credit-bearing program. And so throughout the K-12 experience, there's ways where the collective bargaining can be honored and still achieve this goal. And then the other point is with the students, there's the bigger picture of we need to honor all laws and considerations. And there's the idea of what's good for the students. So with learning loss due to COVID, with all the social emotional trauma due to social media and isolation, we found that our program fits a need at a very deep human, almost mammal level of working together, striving together, helping each other, let alone the math skills, let alone the career exploration and all the other benefits. So the schools that we work with, they have done the calculus. They've found that their insurance companies view it like using scissors, so it doesn't change that. They found that by using electives or other methods, they can honor the collective bargaining agreements, and they found that the benefits are worth it. And again, it's a way of co-opting and having a collective will and creating the way.
Love that, because we're huge advocates on Career Tech Ed. There's a lot actually that you've already explained, Michael, about, you know, the history. There is obviously mathematics in here. And like when we go to, across the states here, there's usually a core four, right? You have math, English, science, and history. And then they throw like different acronyms out there like STEM and STEAM and all these different things. And this is why I want to come to you, Patricia, and ask you a little bit about in your experiences and maybe some of the happenings in New Jersey around CTE and or credentialing. Michael talked a little bit about a program, and we'll get back into that a little bit more about why you're getting college credits. So one of the things that we run into here in Illinois is there's a lot of graduation requirements that are coming from the state. Now, we also know that Michael's students who are using his products and his curriculum are learning other things, math, science, English. How does that work if you want to get some more, you know, check boxes, if you will, to get through your graduation in high school or your credits in middle school? What kind of things have you seen and what are some maybe opportunities that people who are around CTE can take a look at?
Yeah, so New Jersey, you know, across the country, you'll see very different rules and laws, right? So, you know, just a little education law 101 or, you know, constitutional law 101, right? You have the separation of powers, you know, everything enumerated to the federal government. What's not given to the federal government goes to the states. And so we look at the Constitution. Education's not there. So why are all of these states saying, well, the U.S. Department of Education is requiring that I do this, that I give this test every so often, once in high school? Well, that's because of the spending clause, right? That's because the federal government has said, states, we want you to meet these requirements. And if you don't, you're not going to get these billions of dollars. So the first layer I always look at when I'm thinking about graduation requirements or any substantive requirements is, what does the federal law require? And right now it's ESSA, Every Student Succeeds Act. And there are a host of testing requirements, you know, other requirements in there that you have to look to first. And then you look to the state requirements. Here in New Jersey, we do have a graduation exit exam. It is based mostly on math and English language arts. And that's a legacy test. That test has been around since the 1980s. And so it's that test combined with different course requirements, right? And seat time that are the requirements for graduation. And so there are certainly schools in New Jersey who've looked beyond that, right? They've created, that's just the floor, right? Their students are doing advanced placement courses. They are doing IB work. Their students are getting credentials. But I would actually say, Peter, there's much more that we can be doing to be able to move towards giving students credentials as they're leaving high school, so they actually can go out and earn right from high school. And so I do think that that's an area of opportunity here in New Jersey for students and for teachers in our education system.
I know when we talked before recording this, Patricia, you said that you'd worked for a nonprofit that was around like policy work and educating teachers specifically. And so I would like to dig into that a little bit here, because you're talking about, you know, educational law 101, but like, what don't teachers know about, you know, federal policy that, you know, maybe could be a jumping off point besides what you just said and just kind of speak about that work, because I was very interested to know. It was stuff I hadn't even really thought of. Peter will say all the time, like, follow the money, but you really know that trail. And so, right, like, what other opportunities do teachers and school districts have they may not be aware of in this kind of legal world that schools sit in?
Absolutely. You know, teachers are in the classroom with students a majority of the day. I'm a parent of three children. The reality is my children are with their teachers more every day than they're actually with me at home. And so, you know, teachers have such an important influence over students. But the reality is there are very few educator prep programs or very few, you know, alternate route programs that actually teach like the legal law surrounding education. And so I did run a nonprofit, an advocacy group, and we created a teacher policy fellowship because, you know, teachers often want to speak up. They have thoughts, they have ideas, but they don't know who to go to. They don't know the politics of who to appeal to, you know. In New Jersey, most of the hearings are actually held during the school day. So what opportunities do teachers actually have to have their voice meaningfully heard at, say, the State Board of Education or at the legislature? So there needs to be, you know, more understanding. There needs to be more focus spent on giving teachers that information so that they can have an active voice. So our policy fellowship tried to give teachers a sense of that structure. And, you know, just one hot button topic that always comes to mind is assessments, tests, right? Why are we testing kids so much? And this is classic federal spending clause, right? The federal government actually has said, you know, you have to test in grades 3 through 8 and once in high school. And when we shared with educators, you know, this is kind of like the legality behind it, their minds were blown. And they were like, really? I had no idea. This is because of a federal law? Like, not because this isn't something we can change. And, you know, when they were thinking about the structure of the test, they saw like, well, there's some opportunity if our state files a waiver asking for flexibility, but there really isn't that much leeway that our state actually has. And once they saw that, they start and they understood the reporting requirements, right? Why we test to be able to be sure that we're actually meeting the equitable needs of all of our students and our diverse learners. You know, they said, oh, you know, now I understand why these systems are in place a little bit more. And it just gave them this structure, you know, a real roadmap from which they could jump off of and say, okay, now that I understand what I'm operating in, here's how I can innovate. Here's how I can best serve my students and how I can best advocate to decision makers about things that they actually can change. Because, you know, you could be advocating for a new test, but if it's a federal requirement, you've got to be at the in DC, not at your local, you know, state capital. So that was really, really enlightening for teachers when we gave them that background and that scaffolding from which they could then advocate for themselves and their students.
So I think like when you do find that wall, that's excellent. Thank you for sharing that. Then, you know, us disruptors of education are going to poke holes through the wall, but you know, you at least know like what you're, you know, as my dog says out in the backyard, what the yard is, right? And then how you can work within it, or maybe even get into another area. So Michael, I wanted to ask you then when you do like, what are some stories that you've heard from, because obviously you put this out into multiple hundreds of schools, you're going to get some pretty creative things happening, especially with assessment and things like that. And maybe these aren't like federal assessments, but talk a little bit about like, what are some of the maybe top two, like very interesting things that people are doing with, you know, your curriculum?
Well, there's four major ways people use our curriculum and our program. One is STEM. And we talk about woodworking is the original STEM. And so it's the idea of design thinking and engineering mindset, that very iterative approach towards problem solving. And so the assessment of that is very direct, where you can show how students are more capable of iterating as opposed to saying, I don't know what to do next. They do know what to do next. The second method, the second purpose is for career exploration. And so for that, generally, and I just looked up Illinois CTE, and even in the high school level, it appears to be an elective.
Yeah.
And so this model of taking a teacher and having them do an elective, possibly as long as it's balanced with their other load, it seems feasible. In that regard, there's two ways. One is that we've done surveys with students to show interest in future careers, help them understand what different pathways exist, and sort of show attitudinal. On the educator side, we have done surveys where they have observed changes in behavioral, meaning better behavioral, better attendance. We even during summer school,
wow.
Better math skills, and then more confidence and desire to continue. So we've got these sort of directional, slightly more qualitative than quantitative results. And we're actually starting to work with some schools in New York City to use anonymous data. And because many schools, when they're running our program, they are setting up implicitly a control expose situation. And so what we're going to do now is measure and see where the lift is between the control group and the expose group, and start measuring for math as well. Another huge metric, not our own, but similar, there's a wonderful program called buildingtoteach.org. Joe Yucha is the director, and he's been doing this for 30 years, using hands-on woodworking to engage students. And we're talking every kind of student, justice-involved youth in Virginia. And he showed, in the end of this is like 1,800. It's a huge sample size. And he showed something like a 30% lift in standardized math scores over about, I don't know, 25 or 30 hours of instruction. They would build boats, an 11-foot rowboat. And between all the social emotional skills and the math skills needed to do that, it was an incredible progression. The other data point is from Job Corps, US Job Corps, which uses the Carpenters Union math book, which Joe helped write, and they showed something like a 4 to 6x improvement over standardized tests. Like it took 1/4 or 1/6 the time to do the TABE, the TABE test. And so there's really powerful data out there to show the benefits of hands-on learning and to kind of prove that gravity exists, that it all, everything we know. So those are some different ways that we've been able to measure the impact and ways that we're looking to measure the impact as well.
I love that because I know like Allie and I, we talk about in our high school, yes, we do have a math and construction course. And I have no idea how they got that going, but they're doing amazing things. As a matter of fact, at the time of this recording, our main educator in that, they do get a math credit for it, here in Illinois, and they're out in Utah right now, going through, I think there's a big conference going on out there. Yeah, I really like that. Do they have anything like this at your school, Allie?
Not like this. I mean, you know, we do have elective type courses. They're more leaned into like the engineering aspect, the robotics. I mean, like there are, but there's no shop class. You have to go to kind of like an outside of the building, either in the morning or the afternoon, and then you do school at the school the other half day. There's a really strong, I'm just forgetting the name of it, tech school in the area that lots of high schools pull from, and go to, and which is a great opportunity because they have so many options. But the idea of working with your hands and from a very young age is it's incredible. And in fact, that it was very common in schools for a very long time. And if you look actually in the Scandinavian countries, they start kids with hand tools at like as soon as possible, like age 3, 4, 5. And it's incredible like what those kids can build and design. And you wonder why, like, I don't know, IKEA has all of these beautiful pieces, and you think, what is that country, and what are those Scandinavians? What are they doing? they're building, they're designing.
But that's their industry, right? And where I've seen the most success in terms of filling right an industry need is where business and industry are leaning in on education too and saying, we have this need. And, you know, I think Mike's program is so unique because he's not just doing it at high school. He's doing it from early on as well. And so, you know, it's a real testament to his program too, that, you know, principals, superintendents who are serving kids of a younger generation see the value in this. But where we see business has a need, they can absolutely disrupt education by putting pressure on the educational system as well, and to put pressure on developing teachers in those areas. You know, we can't create students to fill an in-demand position if we don't have the educators to actually teach them as well. So there needs to be this, you know, back and forth conversation between business and industry and educators as well that's happening, so that we're actually preparing students for the jobs that they need in the future as well.
How do we make that a law?
Well, here in New Jersey, actually, our county vocational schools, they have to have on their county board, they actually have to have business representatives. Yeah. And so, you know, down in Southern New Jersey, we actually have, you know, a major airline engine company that sits on a board of a vocational school that is helping to drive the industry.
So I talked about our mission, but our vision is to create a survey class for middle school students that spans all relevant high growth, high wage, high demand jobs, which is as defined by the Department of Labor for their Perkins grant. And so that it would become almost free for them as well. And this way, for that sixth grader, and I don't know if we've talked about this, but sixth graders, there's some of them are already thinking about dropping out of school. You know, so this idea of waiting till 11th grade and then you choose is unrealistic. And so we're seeing a lot more energy towards starting early and helping these students before they're too damaged, frankly, by thinking poorly of themselves because they're not good at sitting still. They're not, but that doesn't indicate that you're smart or not. It just indicates you're not good at sitting still. And there's a lot of jobs where you don't sit still. So the point is, starting early is important. Then the idea of what's relevant for their future careers, we're looking at, we've already developed content for offshore wind for here in New Jersey, huge industry. And so we're working with the New Jersey Economic Development Authority, the Carpenters Union, as well, because most of the jobs in offshore wind are in construction and electrical. It's not about the setting up the wind turbine itself. That's 10% of the jobs, but 90% are manufacturing. So we're looking at manufacturing, healthcare, cosmetology, anything that gives a chance for a child to say, oh, I kind of like that. And now when maybe I will stay in school. And there's other studies that have shown that doing CTE in middle school increases attendance, increases graduation rates. And so starting them on this pathway early with industry influence, there's, car companies in Alabama and are always, they've got pipelines from high school to the factory floor. Same with solar in Ohio, same with everywhere. The more the industry involvement, the better. And we're helping the carpenters a little bit with a program in Newark called a 311 program, which not only gives the kids exposure, but it gives them mentors. So it's one thing to be aware of future careers. It's another to have someone take you under their arm and show you what it's like. And so again, with industry engagement, all of this is possible, because they can provide the work sites where students can visit. And if they're under 18, they're still wearing a hard hat, but they're not lifting anything. When they're over 18, they could still be in high school and they're actually getting real jobs. And that's what this 311 program does. It's these students are earning tremendous wages in high school and getting real work experience. And again, the insurance is either from the school or from Workforce Development Board or from the contractor itself. Often the Workforce Development Board, at least in Newark, very strong leadership. And so they cover a lot of these sticky issues like insurance that makes it possible for employers to say, sure, I'll give a kid a chance. I'll bring them on site. The more engagement, the better. But it's this public private partnership that, and maybe Patricia, a lot more about this than I do, that's been really powerful. Right.
I mean, when a decision maker hears, right, or, a board, whoever is making the law, the decision, right, when they hear that industry is behind this as well, right, there is a need, right, there is a pathway for these students, right? And, they perk up and listen, right? It gives them the opportunity to say, wait a minute, I should consider this, right? Because this is not just kids tinkering with something, right? Like, there is a real meaningful pathway here. And I think that's one of the keys, right? Like, again, having a passionate leader, right? A well thought out plan, but then this engagement, right? The stakeholder engagement where you've got many people at the table, then validating this as it's going through the process, it just makes it that much easier. And it makes the conversations that much more focused where they need to be, such that it can't get derailed by minor hurdles that really can be overcome if you use some creative thinking and where there's, a will.
Speaking of the creative thinking, it's funny, as we mentioned, like seat time, and that's an interesting term. And I just kind of wanted to ask you quickly about that. Number one, teaching is not a lot of seat time, right? So that's kind of funny that we're in a school and we call it seat time. How creative can you get with that quote unquote seat time? Because I wholeheartedly agree with you and Michael about, getting these kids younger and just exposing them to as much as possible. But then you have that seat time and you can only do so much in seats. Field trips, everything like that costs money. Have you seen, describe seat time? Because that's such I feel like that's an outdated term. Like, I think it should be learning time or cognitive time or something. I don't know.
So it depends on the state and it depends on the county, the jurisdiction that's in charge of the actual schools. But, it's essentially how much time a student is spending learning, right? And so the key question I always like to look at is the curriculum, right? Does it fit into the curriculum, right? Can it be complementary, right? So that you are, enriching the curriculum through an activity like this, right? So Mike said, before, right? They're sometimes getting credits. That's the key, right? You don't want to be adding too many things to a plate, because then you do run out of time to actually teach what is mandated in a state, in a district. And so the key is looking for where you can integrate it. But essentially, seat time is saying you need students to actually be in school for a certain amount of days, for a certain amount of time, focused on academic learning. So, you know, the good leaders will look for those creative ways to get in the experiential learning and check multiple boxes mm-hmm. so that a student has a well-rounded experience.
Exactly. You know, in New Jersey, there's a state mandate for, I believe, 1.5 credits of CT in middle schools, mm-hmm. but it's not, people do it with worksheets or visits. And then we argue, well, that's fine, but instead of spending your money on transportation, on a field trip, spend it on, invest in here. And we have one school, for example, in southern New Jersey, and they're in two middle schools, they're putting the entire seventh grade, 370 students, through a short program, but at least they get 5 hours of seat time, if you will, of woodworking, right? And then there's going to be 5 more hours of something else, and they have, I don't know, 5 or 8 different trades that they're giving these kids exposure to. And so it's just tremendous. So yes, you can have it both ways if you think creatively about it. But and a lot of states are mandating, you know, career exploration starting even in elementary school, mm-hmm. right? So it is interesting if there's a confluence of these things, makes it a lot easier.
Creative opportunities for students. I feel like many people have ideas. They have, you know, they want to help out in schools, or they might be in the school. They might be a parent of the school. They might be a local community member. They might be an industry. And so this, what I'm hearing a lot in this conversation is that the more people at different levels that you have invested in a project, as well as understanding the laws behind what you can and cannot do, is going to give any type of creative opportunity more success. But from either one of your perspective, with the work that you do or work that you've heard about, what have you found is kind of like, you know, besides like this charismatic leader and, you know, the federal mandated requirements, do you find that creative opportunities happen better or more efficiently, like from like the top down, like being, you know, or these kind of integrated, like community, starting small and then growing? Because we've talked to people at both levels. And so I'm just from the legal and level, and then Mike, with your work that you're doing, you know, what do you kind of see as like the recipe for success for creative opportunities to get kids out of the traditional school model?
I mean, in my experience, it's the teachers, right? The teachers who've got that great idea, right? And they go to the administration and they say, I want to try this. And, you know, build up camaraderie amongst their colleagues. And, you know, then from there, it spurns and you have a domino effect and replication. To me, that's what I have seen be most effective, because they're an authentic advocate in the classroom. Leadership from the top down is great if that leader has had proven experience, right? And has the respect of the people under them. There's respect and admiration, right? And trust that what is being, you know, new, that is being tried, right? Those teachers are usually willing to give it a shot and then see if they like it. But usually if it's coming from one of their own who is stepping up, there's just kind of that like instant trust, right? That someone who's walking the walk, who's talking the talk, just like you are, down the hallway every day, is going to spend their time and resources like outside of their normal job to do this. It just seems to spur creativity. It seems to spur an interest, and it just ignites and takes off.
What we've seen in a couple locations is that going back a little bit to the private-public partnerships, the idea of what's the economic outlook for that geography. So take a Long Branch, New Jersey. You know, it's like the population, I think it's like 70% Latinx. Lot of labor jobs needed, a lot of opportunity down the shore for construction, for offshore wind, et cetera. There's a lot of infrastructure projects coming to this part of New Jersey as well. And so the school thinking about, well, what are our students going to do after high school? And what are the economic opportunities? And so then that led to a partnership with the Carpenters Union, which led to a high school program, which led to a middle school program to keep kids in school until high school. So at Maplewood Shop, we think about almost, you think about like a staircase. And the first step is middle school. The second step is high school. And the third step is after high school, say the 4 years after high school. And so how do we in middle school prepare students to graduate, stay in school, and then go on to a job or go on to an associate's degree or a bachelor's degree? We're agnostic. We, whatever works for the student. If they want to become a surgeon, wonderful. If they want to become, you know, a carpenter and do drywall, fantastic. But it's really about that connection of the school in its community and the economic outlook. And so the various trades or opportunities are going to vary. And there's always going to be a certain cohort of the student body that is not college bound. And I think it's important for us to talk about that. And that there was some reporting in the Times recently about, unless you pursue a STEM related degree in college, you kind of have a 50-50 chance of having your degree pay off in terms of wealth after decades because of the size of your student loans that prevents you from owning a home. And so I'm very pro education at all levels. And it's really interesting to think about how things are evolving and what's the value of an associate's degree in construction management or a bachelor's degree in construction management, and what are ways that you can earn while you learn. And so that when you're young and you want to be out and super active, you can be in earning. And when you're a little older and your back hurts and your knees hurt, you cannot be, and but still have a nice pathway through your entire career. So I wonder what, you know, this team has seen in terms of educators and how they're thinking about the economic opportunities in their communities as a way to guide them towards what's worth doing in the middle school, for example.
I love that. The marrying of CTE, the legalities behind it. We've got a lot of information that you all sent over the airwaves here. I know I've learned a lot, but Allie, I gotta always ask you, what are your final thoughts? It's too much. It's so great.
There's so much. I had to take notes because, I mean, you guys have just been incredible. I just want to say thank you so much for coming and chatting with us. I know our listeners are going to love this episode because I'm like, I know we could keep talking. We're probably going to have to do a part two with the follow-up here. My main takeaway, and I want to encourage school leaders, teachers, who are considering future programming for students, and the software wave is here, AI wave is here. But something you said, Mike, you said we need to get away from pixelated perfection, and the way your program literally takes kids off the screen to create something real is what more school districts need. And, you know, we can be on a screen as much as possible. You know, it's like so addictive, but getting kids and getting them earlier to working with their hands is irreplaceable. And I will say that over and over again, but I love that phrase. And then Patricia, the encouragement I think our teacher listeners are going to have when you said, you know, teachers are the authentic advocates for change, is empowering and refreshing to hear, because oftentimes as educators, you can feel like you can't make any changes. And so knowing that there are lawyers, people, there are lawyers out there who want to work with teachers and school leaders that want to do change, I think is going to be wildly encouraging for those who listen to the podcast and who find this podcast because of what you're talking about.
So let's get them connected. Before we end this, definitely want to get your information. So we'll start with you, Patricia. I know there's a book coming out here somewhere. There's got to be. Come on. So, but how can people connect with you and see what you and your firm are all about around education and law?
Absolutely. You can find me on LinkedIn, Patricia Morgan, and I'm at the law firm of Corzio Bromberg and Newman, and I work on our government affairs team for Corzio Government Affairs as well. So always happy to have a conversation with anyone.
Thank you. And Michael, obviously, you've got a great, great curriculum here. I'm loving it. I'm thinking about talking to a few people around here on that. How can people connect with you and find out more about your amazing stuff that you're doing?
Thank you. Maplewoodshop.com, all one word, maplewoodshop.com. And otherwise, you can find me on LinkedIn as well, Michael Schloff in New Jersey. And yeah, we're on Facebook, Twitter, X, whatever, everything. And then if you Google CBS and woodworking, you'll find the segment. And
yes, we will definitely link that in the show notes as well, so people can see that. Michael and Patricia, thank you so much for the vast amount of information. I do agree with Allie. There may be a part two here somewhere where we go deeper. And I know that a lot of our listeners will probably be reaching out or connecting. And I am just humbled to know that, yes, this does exist. There are hands-on things that we can use tools, bring back shop. I'm all about it. Safely, of course, Patricia.
Always.
Thank you both for hanging out with us here on the Disrupt Education Podcast. For Allie Privet, I'm Peter Hostrasser. We'll catch you next time on the podcast. Thank you so much for joining us on this week's episode of the Disrupt Education Podcast. Be sure to like and subscribe so you never miss an episode.
Are you ready to disrupt the educational arena you're a part of? For more ways to get involved in the work we do here at Disrupt Education, check us out at disrupteducation.co or find us on LinkedIn at Peter Hostrasser or Allie Privet.
Our mission here is to help facilitate and amplify changes in the educational system through local initiatives and help you scale them into community movements. Our building network of disruptors in education are working to move beyond scores and grades as the only measure for student learning. If your school district, college campus, or organization is looking for facilitators of this work, reach out on our website or social media.
And if you have any thoughts or feedback on this week's episode or any episode, we'd love to hear from you. Until next time, keep pushing the boundaries, taking risks, and most importantly, disrupting education.